Well, is there any, sorry about that, Brian, but is there anything else you wanted to mention about your retirement activities?
Well, of course, yes, I do. I've always had hobbies of music and hiking in the mountains, and I guess those haven't decreased perceptibly, although I'm not as fast a hiker as I was, but I don't know whether this can go in this private record. I guess I'm proud to say that this fall I completed, since turning 70, once again, the ascent of the 48 4,000 foot hills in New Hampshire. Hmm. I first did that back in the 1950s and done most of them more than three times, but after turning 70, I noticed, my God, I've done quite a few of them again. Why don't I try for the whole lot? So I've done it.
Of course,
now I hike with my grandchildren.
Yeah.
But I'm slow. As to the music, that's continued. I mean, not only with Ron, but I have some local colleagues, not professionals. We have a piano quartet or quintet performance generally once a year, so I've done some of the really great chamber music works in a sort of, there's a weekly amateurs concert in the music department, and
okay.
I've been allowed to take part in that. Research, necessarily, since there are no more co-workers right now, it's not ostensibly less, but in the last year, somehow, more things have happened. I got an idea about the thermodynamics of associating polymers in solution as a result of reading a couple of papers in macromolecules, and that's led to one paper and to now a collaboration with another Japanese long distance by correspondence. So while I'm going there in May, last year I was made an honorary member of the Society of Polymer Science in Japan.
Mm.
Michael Schwartz was too. There haven't been too many from the U.S. Well, Mark, of course, Flory, of course, Huggins, George Smets from Europe. I don't know. A handful of others. Some obviously should have been, but aren't. Dick Stein, for example, who's had far more contact with the Japanese than I isn't yet, but he's not old enough yet. He's only 65. Anyhow, I couldn't go last year to accept the thing, but they've set up a meeting, a place for me at their annual meeting this May, so I'm going over there.
What about, do you have any new ideas in polymers that you want to do?
Well, new wrinkles on old ideas. I wouldn't say they're new, no. In thinking about these associating polymers in solution, I come across another, I say small riddle in the theory that I'm trying to iron out, but it's not worth talking. On the polysulfone side, for years the dielectric properties made us all think there must be helices in them, but since they don't crystallize and the optically active ones aren't optically active enough, we haven't been able to demonstrate in any direct way that there are helices. However, I have a colleague over in biological sciences, George Rubin, who's a very skilled transmission electron microscopist. He's got some really new techniques and can see down to very small dimensions of the order of 10 angstroms. We think we now see the helices where they ought to be. I've got a paper coming at the ACS meeting in April. George will give the paper, I won't. But, that's a 10-year search that's culminated in apparent success. Of course, it again may turn out that it's all
trying
to write up old stuff, but I'm awfully slow at that. I've never been able to dash off something the moment it should be done. There are periods when all of a sudden you can dash off anything and it goes on and on successfully, but then in between are these long dry spells. I just so admire people who can discipline themselves to write promptly and regularly. John Ferry, Paul Flory, but John Ferry is the outstanding one. He always wrote up everything promptly and on time.
Well,
I can't do it.
One other thing I wanted to deal with in detail was your consulting work for DuPont, because we touched upon that in the last interview. You basically indicated that you more or less fell into working with the DuPont plant at Arlington in New Jersey.
Right.
And that's basically how you got started. Maybe we could try and deal with this in, more compactly here.
Okay.
How exactly did you get involved with the DuPont people?
Well, that's in the other interview. They even asked me if I'd like to be interviewed for a full-time job, and I did listen, but decided, thinking also of my previous small experience, summers working in an industrial lab, that I probably hadn't got the right temperament for that.
No.
But I was bold enough to say, if you want an occasional consultation, maybe I can come that way. And they bought it, and they said, well, come 12 days a year, come to Arlington. Bill Meyer is coming down. He was a student of Dubai. You and he can certainly talk to each other, which turned out to be eminently so. And so I got started on it. And then when the old plastics department became polychemicals, and when the research part of it was moved down to Wilmington, I started coming to Wilmington. And it's gone on and on.
So what kind of problems have DuPont, I mean, obviously you can't tell me about the latest ones, confidential, but what kind of problems have you dealt with at DuPont over the years? I mean, is there a pattern of things that the
it's easy to say. I mean, to the extent that methods of polymer characterization have wanted to be talked about, well, my own experimental experience, such as it was, plus knowledge of the theory, I could give them some useful hints now and then. And in return, for example, back to our funny polyoxymethylene, when Delrin was made and they found some solvents for it, hydrated hexafluoracetone, for example, they gave me some samples, and I had a master's student before our doctoral program make light scattering on those solutions, so that the correct data on polyoxymethylene that was finally obtained in our laboratory came only because I knew the DuPont people. They told me that there was such a solvent before that was published, and by the time we did the work, it was published, and they gave me the samples of various chain lengths, so we could never have made that polymer in our kind of rudimentary laboratory. So I would say there was a two-way street. It was very helpful academically. Of course, you enjoy making contacts between good students or other people looking for jobs in an outfit like DuPont where they might be useful.
Have there been DuPont chemists that you've been particularly associated with over the years? I mean, are there particular people at DuPont you've come to know very
well? Bill Meyer and Beasley, for example, with whom I published papers.
Yeah.
Bill Meyer several times. John Beasley, now retired, another one. He was a MIT PhD, so I knew him already from grad school. In fact, I used to say the reason that Polychem and then Plastics kept me on as a consultant so long was because I had convinced Beasley that's where he ought to go to work. He was an outstanding man, best graduate student of his era at MIT, but he wanted to work in industry. He'd been a chem engineer by background, and apparently worked at Tennessee Eastman with it at the end of the war. He knew he wanted industrial research. And interviewed at DuPont, several departments, but not Polychem. No. And I said, John, I think that's the place for you. Why don't you ask him if you can interview there, too? So he did, and he liked it, and he got the job. So I claim credit for selling DuPont and Beasley to each other. And he did so well for them in ways which, of course, are in the company that I used to joke and say, that's why the company is a consultant.
But anyone? No.
Amongst the others over the years, well, Howard Starkweather, who's still working.
All right.
He'd been there ever since the late 40s. Amongst the people I didn't do science with, but knew as friends and who were more involved with the management thing was my old Oxford roommate, Bill Franha.
Okay.
William A. Franha, and Ed Bloom for many years, the sort of personnel director there, retired now. And before that, Ed Cooper, a physicist, long retired. Well, it's been varied, and most of them are not long, continued things. Well, I must say there's another problem, a mathematical problem that I solved thanks to the interest of two people at the Philadelphia Laboratory of the Fabrics and Finishes Department, where once in a while I would go to consult. They were working on emulsion polymerization, and the people were Seymour Hofberg and Werner Zimt, and these people wanted to talk about the kinetics as a function of the particle size and all that business, and I read up on that a bit, and there was this paper by Smith and Ewart, which is sort of the fundamental paper on the business, but they had a mathematical relationship that they hadn't solved except in the limiting case. Well, again, I remember riding the train from Philadelphia to New York up to Boston, and on that train I got the idea to solve that problem. So it's one of those.
Right. Perhaps you could draw on your experience with DuPont, which now goes over 45, 46 years.
Yes.
I mean, what are your thoughts on the nature of academic and industrial collaboration? I mean, is it profitable for both sides, do you think?
I'd like to change the question a little bit. What I've observed mostly, and of course it's obvious to lots of people, I guess, that the range of problems that an industrial research organization chooses to contemplate seems to be very much a function of the marketplace. And even of the management in a particular laboratory. At the DuPont Experimental Station are many what used to be called departments. The name department has disappeared within the year. I don't know what taken its place. In any case, simultaneously we find in one building the people who are running the show didn't like mathematics, they didn't like theory, they just wanted people to get in there and polymerize more bottles of this and that, and or else make more test pieces and improve the tensile strength. And really empirical things. At the other extreme, at times it appeared that people thought, well, the way to solve all our problems is by outdoing the academic people at being academic.
Right.
And some of them were very good and could do that. Others who tried to imitate it produced only second-rate academic kind of stuff.
Right.
And that I've seen, too. Where does the consultant fit in? Well, obviously, when they're an academic kick, he's much more involved personally and be able to talk to what's going on. Some of the other times, in fact, I could say recently, I've been feeling that I haven't been so useful to them. You don't know, of course, when you were useful. You may say something in such a way that later they get an inkling of something that came out of the way they presented it to you.
But
it's clear that there are some people like Roger Adams and Speed Marvel who, to the predominantly synthetic chemical fraternity of the DuPont outfit, have been of transcendent value, and Jack Roberts, I fancy, has been very valuable in that way. I never knew that I could think of myself in that ballpark, but they haven't fired me, and I call up now and then and say, well, I haven't been down lately, do you want me? And the the answer now, it's done by a woman who is not herself a scientist. She said, well, I'll send around a notice, and if I get enough response, we'll have you come down.
Right.
Well, I did this at fairly short notice for them when I got your message, and it worked out. So they do have me for a day tomorrow.
I mean, let's talk a little bit about the mechanics of compound hydrogen.
Yeah.
I mean, to you, it's probably fairly obvious that this sort of thing doesn't always get on the record.
It has varied. Now and then I was told, this is the area where we want you specially to be useful, so please keep abreast of things going on in this area, and we'll meet regularly whenever you come with a group that deals with these things. Whenever I've done that before, it didn't seem to last, perhaps because I wasn't successful at keeping my end of the bargain. But there have been other times when, I mean, the same person I've seen year after year, and generally over in an area that's, of course, the scientists there and work there had changed faster than my own, but I've got enough bread so I could stay with it. Some people with whom I do seem to be able to exchange ideas and wanted to see me, but it's their choice whether they want to see me or not.
Right.
But in my case, I would say probably the majority has been short-term shopping.
Okay.
People are supposed to know what I may know and say they'd like to talk to me. Occasionally people have come and expected me to know something, and I haven't had the slightest idea. Well, they haven't come back. But other times, people have come from laboratories. People have come from Virginia up to the station when I'm there, or from Philadelphia, and I've been able to help them because they knew what I knew.
Okay. Right. I mean, it seems to me that do you talk to them much on the phone? It seems to me that consulting always seems to take place face to face.
How's that?
Sorry. It seemed to me that consulting always seemed to be a face-to-face matter.
It
don't get people from DuPont calling you up in Dartmouth and saying, can you help us with this, you know?
Once in a very great while something like that has happened, or even somebody's come up, but that's rare. No, it's mainly face-to-face. Okay. There was something, only a couple of years ago, I was asked, in fact, to look into a certain matter, and predictably, most of those have had to do with some sort of a patent case.
Okay.
Explore a certain idea. Is it feasible, or is it not an idea to be patented, but is the opponent's or the rival's statement sensible? What can you say about this whole area? If I have to spend a few hours in the library, I'll produce a calculation and send it to them. Well, then I'll tell them how many hours, and then they'll send me a check, but I don't know what my hourly charge is. I don't recall. It goes per diem, so if I have half a day, I get half a day. That's about it.
But what about, has DuPont ever aided your research? I mean, have they ever funded any research for you?
They haven't, and for years, certainly when I was most active, their policy was they fund chemistry departments all over the United States. They have a big research program, and they give no special consideration to people who happen to be their own consultants.
No.
That was their policy for a long time.
Yeah.
I don't know whether that's changed. It may well have.
No. But I was just going to say that, has your sort of relationship with DuPont sort of varied over the years? I mean, have you detected a greater enthusiasm for academic contacts at some times than others?
Well, sure. Again, it's a function of the marketplace, or in part maybe of the person who's running the show.
Have you ever consulted for other companies apart from DuPont?
With their knowledge, becoming they were first in the, for a few years, you will be amused, the American Chicle Company that makes chewing gum.
Oh, right, I haven't mentioned that yet.
Did I mention it? Or?
No, I think it was Woodward, because Woodward was a consultant for American Chicle for...
But here's how it happened to me. One of the people who had been an instructor of organic chemistry at MIT when I was an undergraduate became their research director. Robert Heggie was his name. And sometime early 50s, I think it was, or possibly just around 1950. I'm sorry, yeah, at that time, they were having trouble getting an acceptable polyvinyl acetate from the manufacturers, who I think were mainly Union Carbide, but there may have been a couple of others. Oh. They wanted a low molecular weight PVA, that was PV acetate. This was a part of the gum base. What was furnished to them was inevitably tainted with the flavor of acetaldehyde. And so they had to go through, and they couldn't get the people there to do a washing process afterwards. It wasn't a large enough volume of business as far as Carbide was concerned. So these people decided, we will purchase a semi-works plant that we know of on Long Island. We'll hire a chemical engineer to run it and make our own polyvinyl acetate, which they did. But there wasn't anybody, including this chem engineer who had been working on quite a different area, who knew anything about polymerization. So this was before Natta and Ziegler came along and made polymer chemistry too big for me. I knew enough about free radical polymerization, so he said, could you help us out designing this plant, or at least telling us, you know, what variables to play with and running it? And so I did, and that's how I got to go down there. I was at MIT in those days. I lived out in the suburbs. I could get on a sleeping car in the suburb of Newtonville, not far from my home, and sleep overnight and wake up in New York in the morning, go out to Long Island City to the chewing gum plant.
Right. So, I mean, did that last for very long? Or was that
Maybe 5 or 6 years, in which, I mean, they did what they wanted, and then they kept me to talk about some other problems and things they were trying to develop, but...
What were they using the polyvinyl acetate for? Chewing gum, or
the part of the gum? I mean, they mix the original chicle. The gum was based on the gum from a plant. Yeah, but during World War II, they couldn't apparently get all they wanted of that, and it just turned out that this polymeric stuff was quite acceptable consistency.
Yeah, I read somewhere, it seems very improbable to me, but I read somewhere that modern chewing gum is a styrene butadiene copolymer. A
certain amount of it's in there too, that's right. Yeah. Yes, some of the standard styrene butadiene stuff, yeah.
Any other companies you want to mention? Or?
Now and then, well, General Electric Company, I spent a summer. There, working with Bruno Zim, 1951. That was when later we wrote a paper with Fixman. I mentioned that in the third thing. Because they had once before asked me to join the research lab, and I had said no, and this time they wondered again if I might like to come there since my friend Zim was there. And I came and spent a summer, liked the atmosphere quite well enough, but it didn't seem to be any obvious reason for leaving MIT, which I liked very well then, and I had my superb bunch of students at that time, so when a home and kids were growing up, no reason to move. And now and then, I would be asked to go over and consult a day with them, so in the later 50s, I did that a few times. It was essentially a minor activity. It didn't conflict in any way with what I was doing with DuPont, so, but that's about all.
Okay, we're coming toward the end of the interview now. I thought that maybe you might like to talk a little bit about Paul Fleury, because of course you wrote that very good account of Fleury's work for Science when he got the Nobel Prize in 1974, and you're working at the moment on the obituary for the National Academy of
Science. So-called biographical memoir,
That's right. So perhaps you'd like to talk a bit about your relationship with Paul Fleury.
I'm only sorry that I didn't see more of him during our lives, because we never worked in tremendous proximity. I would see him at lots of meetings, and we corresponded about science on occasion. We didn't always agree, as I've already mentioned, in connection with the theory of the gelling polymer after the gel point has passed. And there was another thing in later years when he didn't like the way Kurata and I were over interpreting some viscosity data in certain systems. When Paul disagreed with somebody, he generally was fairly quick to say so, or even to write so. Somehow, I think because he really enjoyed our friendship, he didn't do that to me. If I did something of which he disapproved, he simply ignored it rather than attacking it.
Wow.
Well, that of course can be annoying too if your work is not mentioned, but in this case he was right, I was wrong, you know, and it was wrong stuff, and he did well to perhaps not mention it. But he was always encouraging. He was not all that much older than I was, 4 years or so, but he definitely, I think, thought the work was good, and of course he hired Fixman at Mellon Institute for a while after Fixman's instructor term at Harvard was over, and that was a wonderful 2 years for Fixman.
And you got on very well with him personally, I think.
Always, yes. And I remember when he was at Cornell. No, the first time I went once to lecture at Goodyear, when Paul was at Goodyear, and he lived way out in Kent then, which was some miles away. Kent State University is there, the one where the unfortunate incident occurred, you know, where the students were shot. But Paul lived in Kent, and I remember being taken out there to visit for the evening. Then later, when he'd moved to Cornell from Goodyear, I went to lecture at Cornell or at some meeting. I was actually a guest in the Florey home. The two girls and young Jack were just still all school children. Both very cordial, and we discovered then that Emily was an ardent Unitarian, and my wife and I had joined a Unitarian congregation back in Massachusetts, so we had a common interest like that.
Yeah.
But we exchanged confidences about what we were going to do. I remember when he decided that he was going to leave Cornell and go to Mellon, he told me very quickly about that. I don't really have the full story of why he wanted to go away from Cornell. I do know he felt a positive obligation to go to Mellon. Maybe he's mentioned that in his own interview. He had told the people at Mellon what he thought they ought to be doing, because he was a member of their board. And then they said, well, you're the man to do it. Come on. And so he said, I felt obliged. I had outlined this program for what they should do. I better go there and do it. Then, of course, they were unable to keep their end of the bargain financially, and he decided to go back to academia.
Well, of course, he returned his
time. And the story of how he got to Stanford instead of back to Cornell is one which Johnson tells in the thing that we're going to publish, but maybe it's already been told by Florey.
Right.
Has it?
I don't really think so. It's really a bit of an untold story.
Well, it's a very funny one. Essentially, at a meeting of organic chemists, Johnson overheard one of Florey's Cornell organic chemical ex-colleagues say, well, we're about to rehire Florey. And Johnson said something like, well, has he agreed yet?
So you were talking about William Johnson.
Yes, well, apparently he overheard the notion that the news that Florey was thinking of leaving Mellon and returning to Cornell, but that he hadn't yet signed up.
Yeah.
So Johnson apparently immediately called the provost back at Stanford and asked if he had, if this was true, or maybe he waited till he got home. In any case, he was
quickly given permission to contact Flory and invite him out to Stanford before Flory
went back to Cornell.
Yeah. Flory did come out to Stanford, and after several visits decided that's where he'd go. But it was all an accidental remark at a somewhere at the social hour of a meeting. Or history might have been different in that respect.
Okay, I think I will